I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Roddy Doyle joins me now. The acclaimed writer is in town for appearances to promote his latest book, The Guts, already a critical success in Ireland, England, and the United States, not to mention this country. It's a follow-up to his noted 1987 novel, The Commitments, which was a huge hit and later an important film. There were also two other books in the so-called Barrytown trilogy, 1990's The Snapper and 1991's The Van. In this new book, The Guts, we see 47-year-old Jimmy Rabbit married with four kids and diagnosed with bowel cancer. The years have sort of caught up with Jimmy, and we see him in a more in more familiar times to today, the Ireland around the time of the economic crisis, with all its attendant challenges, financial and otherwise. The love of music, the breeze of nostalgia, and the banter, both funny and sad, always wise and honest, is all there. I'll get Mr. Doyle to tell us about this book, as well as the time of life he depicts therein. Roddy Doyle was born in Dublin and has written nine novels, two short story collections, and a memoir about his parents. He won the Booker Prize in 1993 for Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. The Guts is published by Knopf Canada. The website for more is at roddydoyle.ie. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Roddy Doyle. Mr. Doyle, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I hadn't read any of your books before I started The Guts. I watched The Commitments also this weekend, and you've turned me into a fan. And,
good.
I don't know why. I hadn't read anything before, but I mean, you know, I've heard of you and all that. I read somewhere that when you wrote The Commitments in the mid-'80s, it took you about 6 months to write. Is that right?
Yeah. How, I don't know. In retrospect, I don't know how I managed to write even a short book in such a short space of time. Maybe because I didn't really know what I was doing. But I started it in January 1986, and I finished it in late June 1986.
And so I guess you didn't have an idea at the time that 25 years later, he'd still be around, right?
It wasn't even an idle thought, to be honest with you, because I eventually published it myself and a friend of mine, John Sutton, in Dublin. We self-published it, its beginnings were quite modest, so to speak. So I had no idea that, more than a quarter of a century later, it would be still in print, available in other languages, a movie that seems to, you know, still resonate, and at the moment, a West End musical in London.
How's
so
that?
It's had a long life.
How's that doing, by the way, the musical?
Doing very well, as far as I know.
Yeah. So, in the process of writing The Guts, I'm assuming that The Guts took a little longer than 6 months to write.
The Guts covers a year in Jimmy's life, but it took more than a year to write the first draft. I think I was running at it for quite a while before I decided it's going to be a year in this man's life, and then I kind of raced through it to try and capture that year. But even at that, it finishes up at a rock festival that takes place in Ireland in late August, but I think it was probably October before I got to the end. It didn't take the year, but the spirit of the year is there, I think. I attempted to do it. It's not easy, you know, to try and condense everything into a year, the work into a year, but I had a stab at it.
In the course of writing The Guts, did you think back to when you first created these characters, say?
Occasionally. I adapted the Commitments for the stage musical, so I'd reread the novel.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't go back to it again. I just reread it. I used it for work on the Commitments musical, but I wasn't thinking of it too much when I was writing the Guts. There was no real need. As well as that, you know, Jimmy's father is a character in The Guts, and he's the main character in The Van, but I didn't reread The Van. I just didn't feel the need to do that. The language was there, and I was constantly reminding myself, it's not the 1980s or early 1990s now, it's 2012, so, you know, just make sure that you don't slip into some sort of easy nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Just make sure the characters remain the age they are now and not the age they used to be. But that doesn't mean that a lot of the energy that Jimmy would have had and the attitude Jimmy would have had when he was a younger man is smothered somehow. It's still there. So I had to kind of get a balance between Jimmy as the character I'd created before and Jimmy as the character he is today. But I didn't actively think back at the Commitments too much or too often. I was, you know, I never sat down to kind of replicate it or to think in terms of it as a, it's been described as a sequel occasionally, and I, you know, I wouldn't lose sleep over that, but to my mind it's not.
Yeah, yeah. Most people who you talk to on this book tour inevitably ask, did you have cancer?
The no,
stuff
I didn't,
that, yeah, the stuff.
Inevitably, I answer no, I didn't.
And then they also ask, the, because you're around the same age as Jimmy is in the Guts, if these things that he goes through are things that perhaps touched your own life.
Well, they touch anybody, any middle-aged man's life, I think. I am Jimmy's what 47 in the mm-hmm. book, and I'm now 55, so I was probably about 6 years older than him when I wrote most of that book, which. If we'd been young men, is a big gap, say between 20 and 26. It's a huge life experience in those 6 years. But it's not a significant gap, really, for as we get older. So, you know, the cancer, for example, it's not my direct experience, but it is direct observation, because it becomes a topic of conversation. It gets onto the agenda when I meet friends of mine now, because, well, there used to be five friends who used to meet, and now it's four, because actually one of my friends died 9 years ago of cancer, asbestosis, and I don't know how many other people I've known well or known, you know, known in that kind of, I know somebody who knows somebody kind of way, who have had cancer, who are still with us, either might be dead, depending on which form of cancer they have. So it arrives somewhere in the mid-40s, and as far as I know, it doesn't go away. So, yeah, and a lot of it is impressions. Jimmy's feeling of redundancy, perhaps, he's almost uncomfortable with his older sons because they're adults now. They're taller than him. They're big guys. They're independent, even though they're still in school. But he can go whole days without seeing them, and that doesn't sit well with them either, you know. And I think a lot of parents feel that they go through a phase, and sometimes they don't come out of it. But most people go through a phase where they have to readjust, where their relationship with their children has to accommodate the fact that they're not children anymore, strictly speaking, although to a degree they always are. So these are, I think, these were emotions that were mine to a degree, but I think also in a lot of cases are common to people of my age.
And I guess does one get wiser, do you think?
Oh, not necessarily. But I think you could say, in a casual sense, that phrase, you know, older and wiser, it does have a certain truth in it, as long as it's not taken literally. To be older is not necessarily to be wiser, because we all know idiots who actually seem like bigger idiots 10 years on, not lesser. But I do think if it's not wiser, it's more experienced, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing, you know, from the writing point of view. I think one of the great things about getting older is that you can use this material, you know. It means probably less people will read it, because if you're writing about middle-aged men, probably middle-aged men are the least reliable constituency you can have, because they just want to read books about war,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I don't know. So they don't want to read books, novels about middle-aged men. But nevertheless, it is the stuff of life. It's something you don't anticipate. But I think it's quite a healthy way to march through life, really, as a writer, is to use the stuff, rather than me, you know, trying to, you know, it's not to say that I wouldn't write a book that's populated by young people. I think I could, and I would, and I might really enjoy it. But my, you know, it's not my direct experience, because there's nothing autobiographical about it, because the urge isn't there. But I'm often inspired by, you know, getting older, little events, feelings. They can inspire short stories. In this case, they could inspire a whole novel.
So I'm in my early 30s. Is this something that in reading The Guts, this time of life is something that I could look forward to, do you think?
Well, it's not. I don't think you should read The Guts as some sort of a primer, you know,
no.
Or some sort of a how to approach middle age. And with a bit of luck now, you won't have to contend with what Jimmy has to contend with. But I think, you know, if you are going to live through middle age, it is there. So, you know, you can declare war on it in some way or other, you know. Botox is always an option. Or you can just settle into it in a healthy way.
Yeah.
An awful lot of people, particularly men, I think, just sit down and don't get up again, really.
Yeah.
They sit in front of the TV and that's it. Whereas, and I'm not advocating that you go out and run all the time. It's just try to be comfortable, I suppose, you know. I'm a little bit uncomfortable even talking about it because I don't want to seem like a life coach or anything, because I'm not. But if you can be, I think myself, you know, if I was talking to myself, I'd be thinking, well, if you can be comfortable or relax into this fact that you're middle-aged, I think it's there to be enjoyed in a way. Because I think a lot of the anxieties that younger people have don't seem to matter anymore, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, it's not indifference, it's just, I think it's a change of perspective.
Yeah.
And that's good.
Yeah.
Probably totally awful if, you know, if you had a middle-aged person's perspective at the age of 30, it'd be probably absolutely awful. But actually, you know, from my point, from my end of the telescope, it seems okay.
Yeah. Now, the people will look to this book, and I'm sure in subsequent years look to it as a sort of time capsule of say, the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Life in Ireland, life in general, I suppose. Do you see that as being its shelf life down the road, say?
I've no idea, really. I was trying to capture, you know, what this fictional man was going through personally, but also in as a citizen of Ireland in that year. Those feelings of anxiety that were abroad, you know, because, you know, people's stability was being nibbled away by the recession, you know. Worried about work, worried about being able to meet the mortgage, worried about, you know, their children's future. It's constant worry, you know. Mm-hmm. Life often has its, you know, big dollop of worry, but I think they were added to they've been added to dramatically during this recession. It's been quite a dreadful time. So it's there to be read as such, and it was quite one very deliberately written, you know, to try and capture some of that. But whether it's seen as a record or not, I have no idea. This is my very last interview, really, on the book, and I'll be consigning it to the shelf and won't be thinking about it again for quite a while, if ever.
Do you really hate jazz?
No. No, I don't.
Yeah. I mean, it seems that, I mean, I thought I read somewhere that you, I guess one of your sons likes jazz, and but you're not a fascist around the house when it comes to music, right?
No, less so than I used to be.
Yeah.
But I enjoy that. You know, I enjoy being the cranky man, you know. It's fun. I used to dismiss all of jazz when I was a younger man. I don't now. It's a bit like all genres. There's good stuff and there's dreadful stuff. And, you know, it's there to be listened to if you want to or whatever. But no, I'm much more open to jazz than I would have been in the past.
Do you write with music in the background?
I do, yeah. More often than not, I do. I listen to a lot of contemporary classical music. You know, Philip Glass, Steve mm-hmm. Reich, people like that. When I need to concentrate on the words, I find that type of music is there to be enjoyed, but it doesn't intrude. Whereas I couldn't sit and listen to a rock album while I'm working on a novel, because the lyrics would get in the way, and probably the cycle of the 3 or 4 minute song and the new song would be, you know, getting in the way or pushing me away from what I should be concentrating on. But I do, unless I'm editing. If I'm editing, I don't listen to music at all. But if I'm writing, I listen to music all day.
Now, sometimes when people write about you, they invoke the name of James Joyce, and you know, you being Irish, I think, is something that people mention quite a bit. Do you find that you're the conduit to which a lot of readers outside of Ireland find out about Ireland, find out about Irish people, its culture, say?
I don't think so. I think I'm one of a group of Irish writers that people put together because we're Irish.
Hmm.
It doesn't occur when you're in Ireland.
Yeah.
Which is just as well. You don't have to be conscious of the fact that you're Irish when you're actually there. You know, no more than, I suppose, you'd, you know, how many people have conversations here about being Canadian. Not, you know, it's just, you know, in your day-to-day living, it doesn't arise. So I don't actually think of myself as being Irish, or when I'm writing, I'm not thinking, you know, will this appeal to people beyond the borders of my country? I don't think in those terms at all. But I do think, you know, reasonably enough, people who read books, and they tend to gather up writers into their, you know, into their stables, so to speak, so that there's... often you might have, you know, within the world of literature, the women writers who write about a certain, you know, in a certain way. Or you might have the women crime writers, you know. Or you might have, Scottish writers, or the East European writers who've been translated into English. And I think people often categorize, you know, myself, maybe Jan Enright, John Banville, Colm Tobin, Colm McCann, Dermot Bulger, Clare Keegan, a lot of the contemporary Irish writers into the same stable, even though the only thing we may have in common is the fact that we have Irish passports and we write using the English language.
Now, you've been all over the place promoting this book. Have we in Canada, do you think, reacted to the book differently than, say, they do in Ireland or in the United States?
Not that I'm aware of. I do know there's been a warmth to for my work in Canada that's been there for a long, long time. I'm not aware of any shift or change or anything there. I don't follow up these things. I mean, I do devote a certain limited amount of time to promotion, but I don't read it. When I go home, I'm home and I'm working on the next thing. So I don't, pursue patterns or anything like that. But the reaction generally to the book has been terrific over the, you know, it's been out a while now. It's just published in the United States, and between Ireland, Britain, Canada, the United States, you know, the reaction has been really, really great, which is nice, but that's consigned to the past now, and I have to work on something new.
Yeah. Now, you've spent some time in Canada, haven't you? I mean, you were on the Giller jury last year.
Yes,
was it?
I've been a relatively frequent visitor, and I've been on holiday here in the West with my family before. I'm not sure how many times I've been to Canada.
Yeah. How did you find the experience of being on the Giller jury? Because you obviously had to read a lot of Canadian writing.
Fell in and out, not just with Canadian fiction, I'm in love with Canadian fiction, but fiction generally, because what happens, you really do overdose on the stuff for a while. You really do feel, I'll happily never read a book of any type again, and then I'll happily never read a novel or a short story ever again. Then you just blame the Canadians for about 6 months. And then things settle down and you start reading fiction again. It is very intense. And there's over, you know, I think there were 127 submissions, so that's a lot of books. There is the bit of excitement when a box arrives to the house and you open it up and it's books you've never seen before, and they've got the covers, and, you know, you begin to dread the bigger books, and you begin to feel so grateful to the authors who've written little short books. And all this, you know, it's all perfectly human. The one thing I didn't like doing was not finishing a book. But that became inevitable after a while, because you just felt, you knew that this wasn't anything that you were going to think was good enough for the short list or the long list, so you had to put it aside. And that always feels a bit of, it almost feels sacrilegious not to finish a book, because I don't tend to pick up books and then put them aside. I tend to finish them. And I've been doing, that's the way I've been, you know, as a reader for years and years and years. But it is it's a good experience. It really is a good experience, because you do see trends, for example. You do see patterns emerging. An awful lot of novels written in the present tense. An awful lot. It used to be the occasional one. But judging by the list of books that I read for last year's Booker Prize, Giller, an awful lot of books written in the present tense. And actually, it wasn't necessarily the right way to go, you know. So I found it interesting and enjoyable, and I loved working with the two other judges. I thought they were great company, and we had great phone calls, you know, Gary Steingart in New York and myself in Dublin, and the three of us, we just laughed a lot, and we just, you know, so I did enjoy the experience, but it's a once-off experience. I couldn't imagine myself jumping at the prospect of being a judge in a big prize like that again. I think maybe once in a life is grand, but if I was asked to be a judge of a big prize where it involves reading a substantial amount of books like that again, I think I'd probably say no. It's the second time I've done it, and I think enough, that's plenty.
Now, we as Canadians are pretty self-conscious. I mean, in the course of the reading that you did for it, did you see a sort of Canadian identity emerge if it wasn't there before, perhaps?
Not really. No. I think you're always aware of the noisy neighbors.
Yeah.
There is that, and there's a lot of work set in the United States. And that seemed familiar, because we have our own noisy neighbors. That was Britain.
Yeah.
we, you know, that one of the things about being Irish is that you have to be determined not to be British,
mm-hmm.
which is daft in a way, but it's less so now, but that used to be the case. And I think probably the same with Canadians, that you perceive yourselves as being a small country. It comes up in conversation quite a lot. I find it hilarious because the place is so vast, you know.
Yeah.
And when you look at some of the Canadian writers on the global scale, and even, you know, Canadian musicians, when you think of all these people that we perceive as American who are actually Canadian, you know, it still surprises me that you have this almost, not quite an inferiority complex, but a kind of more modest, maybe it's part of the Canadian character, a more modest assessment of yourselves as a cultural force. So, but there was a lot of work set in the United States, which surprised me. A lot of the work that wasn't very good never got, you know, say something written by a young Canadian writer set in New York, and at times chapters were little more than travelogues, as the writer was trying to persuade the reader that he or she was at home in New York, you know, as opposed to being, you know, something else. So at times that trip south across the border didn't really work. But that was the case in one or two books, if I remember rightly. But good writing is good writing, you know. And
mm-hmm.
Certainly the long list and certainly the short list was a fabulous list of books.
Say, has anyone ever brought to your attention the similarities between, say, Filipino people and the Irish? But
no.
My parents are Filipino. I was born in Canada, but I certainly know about Filipino culture and the sort. And in reading your work, it seems that there is a similarity. I mean, both countries are sort of colonial countries. There's a great influence from the Catholic Church, and Filipinos and Irish tend to be rather practical people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just thinking about...
What are Guinness sales like in the Philippines? No, nobody's ever drawn their attention to that.
No, I just...
I'll go home to Ireland now and pretend that's my own thought. Could be starting something new. We'd never know.
Well, Filipinos like to drink, so, I mean, that's you know...
Yeah, well...
There you go.
We must be cousins.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and I tend to be a pack rat, too. I mean, that's a stereotype of Irish people, right?
What do you mean by that?
Like hoarding things, keeping things, like, you know, boxes of stuff.
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
No?
As an Irish trait, no.
No?
No, I think a lot of people just fling stuff over their shoulders and forget all about it.
Yeah. Yeah,
no, I wasn't. It's not something I'd ever considered a particularly Irish trait. I'm not a hoarder myself, really.
Yeah. Are you always writing, say, on this book tour? Did you find that you have the time to sneak away?
No, I had very little time this time around. I've been away nearly 2 weeks, and it's been very busy, and I've had very little opportunity to write. So the occasional hour here and there, I can't really work in airports or in, you know, even on trains. Depends if the train is packed. No, it's not an option. But the occasional hour here and there in a hotel room. But other than that, no.
And in reading about you and looking at the prodigious output, I mean, it's a rather busy life, I'm assuming. What sustains you as a writer? I mean, looking at this list of books that you've written, I mean, there's not a shitty book here. So, I mean, you must be doing...
That's as good a compliment as I'm going to get today, really.
you must be doing something, right? I'm wondering what that
is.
Well,
I work full day, you know.
Yeah.
I work from 9 or sometimes before 9 till 6 o'clock, and I don't have a commute because I work at home. So it's a full day, and I tend to, you know, divide the day into different projects. I'd often be working on a children's book at 7 a.m. now, I think. I might be doing something for TV. I'll always be working on a novel, although having said that, I'm not at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd always work, and the reason I do it is because I like it. You know, I find I get great satisfaction from the craft, you know, putting down the words and then, you know, reacting to the words and deleting words or adding a word or deciding to, you know, change the shape of the page a bit. And I see it as a craft almost, as if I was working with wood perhaps as much as I am with words. And I get great satisfaction from that. I really do enjoy it. And, you know, I've always taken pride, you know, old-fashioned male pride in the fact that I can, you know, earn enough to sustain and to keep my family, you know?
Yeah.
And there are, you know, I do have a mortgage, and I do have, you know, the other things, the other anxieties that people would have. So even if I had, even if I did feel that I was beginning to, what would you say, run out of ideas, I would have to, you know, I'm not in a position not to work, you know? And I actually, the more I think of even having said that, it's kind of hypothetical, because the notion of not working, I find almost upsetting. Holidays are great, but no, they're only holidays. So, but I think it's just love of starting off a new project. It's like a new job to an extent.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm my own boss, so it's like a new job, but you are your own boss. So it's just, I feel a bit blessed because I'm doing exactly what I want to do.
Now, as a craft, do you find the longer you do it, the work is easier or better?
I don't know. I don't feel I'm in a position to say whether it's better or not. And it's not easier. And if it felt easier, I'd be worried. You know, because it is anxiety, or, you know, worrying the page and worrying about what you're doing until you're happy with it or happier with it is very, very important of the whole part of the whole editorial process. So I'd hate to think I'd slip into some notion that because I've written 10 novels or because I've won a prize here and there, that I automatically write good prose. That isn't the case, and never could be the case. So I always feel I have to be careful. And that's, again, it's part of the job, you know. And it's a healthy thing. You know, I feel about, say, when I'm starting a new novel, I feel the same excitement I felt when I was starting a new novel, say, 20 years ago. But I'll also feel that I have to achieve it in the exact same way. I don't feel I can cut corners or deliver something that I may not be happy with because I am who I am. Those possibilities never really arise in my head. I don't let them.
Do you think we'll ever see Jimmy again?
I don't know. I wouldn't be close to the idea, but I wouldn't be jumping. At first, I was very tempted to start another novel because I had enjoyed writing that one, but I think it's probably a creative mistake to go straight back into Jimmy Rabbit again. So I would be open to the idea. I'm often open to the idea of returning to characters. I've done it before. Probably do it again. But it wouldn't be a plan.
Roddy, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you very much.
The website for more, roddydoyle.ie. The book is called The Guts. It's from Knopf, Canada. Roddy Doyle joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.